order. And welcome to the committee members who are here. We hope to see some more here soon. We are going to begin with an informational meeting today, and we are going to enjoy hearing about the Greenfield era that is just now unfolding in the Department of Administrative Services. Mike, would you come forward, please?
Well, thank you, Chair Wilson. I appreciate the committee taking a minute or two, and I just wanted to take the opportunity and talk a little bit about Department of Administrative Services and kind of what I'd like to see. And I brought some blank paper because I'm certainly interested in any thoughts that the members might have as well. I think it's important that the Department of Administrative Services be seen as and act as a management tool for state government. And I think it should be a management tool both for the governor and for the legislative assembly. The Department of Administrative Services does prepare the governor's budget. However, after the legislature approves the legislatively approved budget, we administer that budget, enforce it, follow up on it, and make agencies accountable for living within it, within certainly the laws that are passed and the budget notes which are passed. And so I'm anxious not only to move the department toward a mechanism that enables accountability to the direction from the governor and from the legislature, but for the legislature and the members to see the Department of Administrative Services as their part of the their equation for success. I want you to feel as though you can rely on the department to provide information, to ensure that the laws and the direction that come from the legislature are followed. And certainly this is not to be critical of the previous any of the previous managers, but I think that there is real movement that can be made in that direction. So that's kind of the message I wanted to come in and put on the record, and certainly be willing to listen to any sort of comments that you might have.
Thank you. Are there any other areas that you're particularly anxious to get into?
I think that it's important, particularly with the some of the things that may be on the ballot in the coming general election, to have early discussion of budget options. We're asking state agencies to take a close look at the their core missions, the things which we must do, which are unavoidable, those things which are desirable, but perhaps might be up for some reduction should the some of those measures pass. We're encouraging the agencies to begin discussions with their partners about those reductions. It is my view that absent the passage of a measure of this kind, at some point, perhaps due to economic downturn, government will be faced with the need to encounter these kinds of reductions. I say that because of my personal experience in 1980 of coming to state government, going to work for Children's Services Division, and about 90 days later, you're getting laid off because of the downturn. So I know from personal experience that that these things happen in government and in business. And so I think good, careful, strategic and business planning is important. I think that the State of Oregon Enterprise Network and automation that we're trying to accomplish and to structure and discipline how the state does that is a very important element. If you look at the leverage that is left both in the private sector and in the public sector to become more accountable, to have information more readily available, and to make your operations more efficient, the automation of information is really an important tool, and really kind of at this point in our social and business evolution, that the thing that we've got to really do as well as we possibly can. And so that's a very high priority for me.
Questions? Let me follow up. Getting back to the subject of measures that could pass in November, and you mentioned that you're beginning talks with the agencies on those.
I know this is a tough area to explore because no one knows what will happen. But what will you do in the course of follow-up with these agencies as we get closer to November? Will you continue a dialogue with them about the possible reality of a passage of something pretty restrictive?
We've engaged six of the largest general fund agencies in the exercise of designing and owning the process that we will have to go through to do this kind of planning. Again, it is my view that a more aggressive approach to following up with the agencies, certainly engaging them and setting the standards and then making sure that those standards are adhered to, is an appropriate role for the department, and it's certainly my intention to assert that kind of interaction. And there's no resistance, certainly, from agency heads. They welcome the opportunity to begin engaging in that kind of discussion and dialogue. And so, you bet. I think that we have to follow up on that. I think that we have to set standards. We have to measure whether they're being met or not, and then we have to have corrective action plans if they're not being met. And so that's the approach that I would take.
Thank you. Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. Mike, do you anticipate involving the governor or his staff in those discussions?
The purpose of the meeting that I talked about was to begin to design the direction that they'd like to get from the governor. Obviously, the governor is a key part of this equation, and the legislature is a key part. And I've discussed with the governor, and he's in complete agreement that we need to bring the legislative leadership in early, not only in anticipation of possible measures, but in planning the budget. And so we've tried to move the budget planning calendar back far enough to leave room for those kinds of discussions to occur. And so we're looking for, again, a much more disciplined, systematic approach to developing those budgets. Theresa McHugh, who is the deputy for the department, and who I told, unless you stay, I'm not coming over, because she knows that budget stuff from top to bottom, is a regular participant in the budget group that's meeting of senators and representatives. And she has made clear to that group that it is our hope that it sees the department as part of their staff to assist them with developing the legislature's approach to budgeting as well. So you bet, the governor is involved with it, and I think the legislature needs to be brought in at the earliest moment.
The questions. Mike, have you seen anything?
Well,
Representative Hansen.
This is on, maybe I could hold off. This is on a different subject than the relation to the initiative.
Go ahead. That's fine.
Okay.
Not a problem.
There's been a lot written and a lot examined on online purchasing, online auctions, using the online auction as a way of procurement, certainly in private industry with significant savings. For the state of Oregon to move in that direction, would there need to be a lot of wholesale changes in legislation to enable you to move into electronic purchasing?
Chair Wilson, Representative Hansen, I don't believe that there is a significant amount of legislation that needs to be changed. I think it's pretty clear that we do need to engage with the legislative leadership about moving in this direction, and certainly their budgetary considerations. We are currently working on the State of Oregon Enterprise Network, having regular meetings with state agencies to begin to build the infrastructure to get us into the what is currently the standard. Let me just digress for a minute and say that we in state government are in a regulatory position vis-a-vis banks, insurance companies, and all sorts of businesses. Those businesses are pleading with the state of Oregon to keep up with them as they develop the ability to operate in the e-commerce field, because if the regulators can't keep up with them, then they've got to slow down in order to do business with us. And businesses need to have the maximum flexibility and the ability to use these automated systems, so that's certainly one pressure. I think our the vendors that we deal with also are outside of government dealing on in e-commerce at that higher level. I think we owe that to them, and certainly the folks that pay the taxes and do business with government need to do the same thing. The thing that we have to understand is that there are lots of citizens who won't have that capacity, and so we've got to be able to run our business in terms of licensing, in terms of purchasing, in terms of selling, in terms of the ability to do all of those things over the internet. We've also got to run parallel with that the paper system, because you can't set the bar for your ability to interact with government is that you have to have a computer with a certain capacity chip in it. Anybody that pays tax or does business with government has to do it at the level they can do it at. And so the first building block is the State of Oregon Enterprise Network, and we're working with the agencies to develop that approach, which will be the foundation upon which will rest the what you're talking about, which is online purchasing and the ability for people to who want to get a license of some kind to do it over the internet. Is that?
Yeah, respond? I think that's good enough for now.
Okay. I'd be glad to talk with you about it and then bring somebody who knows a lot more than I know about it with me.
I would be very interested in how you're developing the strategies and the strategic thinking in terms of is there a potential to be purchasing in blocks with all other 50 states, or do we align ourselves with private industry in Oregon? What are the strategies to get, because this is a whole different world.
I'd be happy to set up a meeting just briefly to comment. I think the objective that we would have there is to join whatever sorts of consortiums we can to get the best price and make sure we include local Oregon vendors so that they're not screened out by using this mechanism.
Thank you. Mike, I wanted to ask about infrastructure as you've seen it relating to DAS, especially the information systems. Representative Hansen began to allude to that. Do you see any big glaring problems within DAS, especially relating to information systems, computer infrastructure, data sharing? Any problems looming there that we ought to know about?
My judgment is that we've got three elements to think about when we think about DAS's capacity. One is whether or not we've got the horses internally to articulate the vision. And the second thing is the vision. What kind of a vision do we have? Does it make sense? does the legislature and governor agree with that vision? And the third thing is, how do you articulate it? How do you sell it to the rest of state agencies? How do you involve local county partners in that process? I'm concerned about the horses that we have internally. And we are hiring in Ann Terry, who some of you may know, to run that internal operation. And I think that we'll be able to have good management of those internal resources. We are also looking inside of DAS itself to align all of our internal information systems resources, because they are dispersed among the agencies. DAS is an 800-person agency, and we have not done a good job internally with putting all of those resources in one well-managed spot. And we're clear, my management team is clear, that that's what we're going to do. And so we're headed in that direction, so that's a concern. I had some concerns about how we were selling this, marketing this to state agencies, and our relationship with the counties. Bill Brawley, who I think is here today, is working on that issue, and I'm optimistic. So the answer to your question is there are three main issues. I think we have challenges in each of those areas, and again, it's a top priority for me, and I think we're on our way to answering them, and I think we'll probably be coming back and talking to the legislature about resources. But first, we're going to make sure that we've gone through our own resource arsenal and extracted all we can, and we can be a lot more efficient. So the answer to your question is yes, we got problems. Good news is we know what they are, and we're dealing with them.
Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Greenfield, and congratulations on your new position.
Thanks.
When you talk of resources, it occurs to me that one of the most important resources the agencies have is their personnel, And obviously one of the charges of this committee has been looking at the retirement system, and we've noticed a lot of retirements happening lately. So I'm curious if you're at all concerned about just the retention of experience in state government as we see people leaving or the chairs being moved around on the deck. What is the administration doing about that?
Chair Wilson, Representative Rosenbaum, I was personally quite concerned with John Yunker's retirement, and the longer I sit in this chair, the more concerned I am about it, actually. I think we're facing the same thing that is being faced across the board. I think there are two issues that we're dealing with. One is that a lot of experience is walking out the door, and I think the workforce is shrinking, just in general. And the third problem is that the Gen Xers want to have fun at work, which presents something of a challenge. And they don't want to make careers sometimes. They want to be in 18 months and then move on to something else. This is a serious problem. We've talked with the governor about it. We've talked with the agency heads about it. And I think we have to, my sense of it is that we are going to be in competition for talented staff with all of the other entities that do hiring in the state of Oregon. I think if we have a well-organized, well-structured government operation where people can come in, get things accomplished, leave at the end of the day feeling like they've accomplished something, that we can compete with the other folks who want to hire these people. We have to start growing within the organizations that we have. Potential managers, and we have discussions, and my plan is to put together a group of folks to work with Dan Kennedy to address this specific issue. But we do have people walking out the door who have lots of experience, and of course the legislature has the term limits issue, and we've got the career limits issue that we're dealing with. So it's a problem. We recognize it. On the other hand, bringing in new folks who may have a different perspective also has some upside, and we'll take advantage of that as well.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you about the governor's executive order the other day, the sustainability issue. How is that? First of all, would you explain that to those of us who don't know what that's all about, and then tell us how that will affect you at DAS?
I happen to bring with me today the full-page ad in the Oregonian by several businesses noting the governor's sustainability order and putting their businesses and phone numbers for those that wanted to. I think that you probably, people who have been in Oregon for a while, 20 years ago even, could have driven around Oregon and seen cone-shaped mechanisms sitting beside sawmills, which we're used to burn slash with. You drive around today, you're not going to see those. Now, that's not because somebody did an executive order about sustainability. That's because somebody figured out that when you're dealing in logs, you're dealing in cellulose, and it doesn't make any sense to burn that stuff up. You can make it into particle board. You can do all sorts of things with it. And so I think that the sustainability order on the part of the governor is simply an articulation of something that's been going on for a long time, which is good business, that you can save money. You can use resources more effectively if you start thinking about not only what you're doing today, but what you're going to do in the future. I think what it means for state government, certainly the governor is wanting us to take a leadership role, is that we're going to be looking for ways when we build buildings, when we rent buildings, when we are purchasing cars, when we are figuring out whether we're going to replace carpet with something else. All of the kinds of things we already do will have the overlay of saying, how can we do this in a sustainable way? Certainly, there are some sustainable things that you could do that would be much more expensive. I think we're going to be looking for the ones which do save us resources and begin to set the tone across state government. And so I think it's just a continuation of what has been a pattern. I grew up in the Los Angeles Basin in the 50s, and I can remember going out into the backyard just like everybody else did with all the paper trash and putting in an incinerator and burning it. And you could look across the basin, you could see everybody's backyard had the plume of smoke coming out. Now I'm lugging stuff out to the curb and getting it recycled. So I think it's just an articulation of what has been going on anyway. And I think in this business climate, if you're not doing sustainability, you're missing a bet, and you're going to lose money, and you're not going to be competitive. And so I think to make Oregon sort of catch up with what's going on in business.
Thank you. Other questions? All right. Well, Mike, thank you, and congratulations on the job. Looking forward to working with you.
Thank you, and certainly think of DAS as a resource, and don't hesitate to call if we can be of any help to the committee or to the members.
Thank you. Appreciate it. All right, we're going to close our informational session, and we are going to open the work session. Subject, e-board reviews. And I'll ask our next guests to come forward, Karen Gregory, OLCC, and Susie Jordan, LFO, if you would come forward, please. And just for the committee, during the 99 session, the General Government Subcommittee of Joint Ways and Means discussed several areas of concern relating to OLCC operations. The reports before us are the result of those budget notes requested by Ways and Means. OLCC was requested to complete these reports by July of 2000, so they're here today with those. These reports have been reviewed by LFO, and we've been asked to acknowledge the receipt of these. This is really an accountability measure that leadership wanted us to do. So that's why we're doing this today. And so we will, as we receive these reports individually and have them explained to us, we will adopt them, adopt the acknowledgement, if you will. So, welcome.
Thank you very much. Would you like me to go first? Actually, I think I'll do a little intro.
Please,
okay.
If you would.
For the record, my name is Susie Jordan. I'm the senior legislative analyst out of Legislative Fiscal Office, and OLCC is one of the agencies that I work with. During the Ways and Means process, the subcommittee raised concerns about some specific areas that weren't necessarily tied to expenditure limitations, but had some policy implications, and they needed to get more information about that, and that's where the budget notes came from. What we have asked OLCC to do is report in several areas, and they are now making that report. In addition, the President of the Senate and Speaker of the House requested that certain reports that were coming forward to the Emergency Board be directed to the Interim Policy Committee as well for your review and acknowledgement. And that's why they are here today, is for you to give you the the request from this, from the leadership, is to give the a broader perspective out there of what some of the issues are that we come up during during session in Ways and Means process. So with that, I'm going to let Karen go ahead and present the reports. And you also have in front of you an analysis from the Legislative Fiscal Office. I think Kara has distributed that to you. That is a summary of the issues and the report, the body of the report. And in all four cases, I'm recommending to you that you acknowledge receipt of that report.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Logan.
Thank you. I would like to ask Legislative Fiscal, I guess, by acknowledging receipt of these reports, are we saying that we accept them? I'm wanting clarification of what we are truly doing here today. Are we saying putting our blessing on them? Are we leaving them open to further consideration? Are we just saying, yes, OLC has done its job and brought us something to review?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loken, what you're doing by acknowledging receipt is simply saying that OLCC has complied with the budget note saying that that requested that they report. You are not accepting or agreeing to the information that's in the report. It is just that you've received it. If the issue warrants further discussion, that is certainly up to legislators to raise that during the legislative session in form of bills. If a bill comes forward from some other, from an agency or for the governor's office, and you also have some additional information with which to base your decisions later on.
Mm-hmm. I'd like members of the committee to feel free today to voice their concerns or objections just for the record today. And again, we have four of these to go through. We do want to break at 12 noon today, so we want to move right along. But yet, we do want to leave time for you to voice your objections to specific issues here.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Karen Gregory, Deputy Administrator for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and I've also asked Alex Lennox to come to the table with me. He is our technical analyst and did a lot of the in-depth work on these budget notes. I appear before you today to report on the four budget notes that Ms. Jordan talked about. And this was directed by the 1999 Legislative Assembly. Three of the four budget notes relate to our merchandising program. Those three budget notes have to do with taking our agent's resignation buyout from a 2% to a 2.5% amount. The second budget note had to do with performance measurements in our merchandising program. And the third budget note had to do with expanding related items in liquor stores to specialty beer and wine, and also expanding the total number of liquor stores in the state. The fourth budget note that we were asked to report on has to do with our regulatory program, and that particular budget note has to do with the cost of actually issuing licenses. So before I get right into those budget notes, I'd just like to give you a very brief overview of the Liquor Commission and what it is that we do and how we came into being. In 1933, a special session of the State Legislative Assembly enacted the Liquor Control Act and created the Liquor Control Commission. The act gave the OLCC the authority and power to regulate and license all people who manufacture, sell, or serve alcohol in the state of Oregon, and it also gave the Liquor Commission the exclusive right to retail distilled spirits throughout the state. Our regulatory program is responsible for licensing all of the businesses that sell liquor in the state, and also individuals who sell liquor by the drink. The program also assures that these licensees comply with all of the liquor laws throughout the state. That's one side of the business that the Liquor Commission does. The other side is the merchandising program. And the merchandising program runs the retail business throughout the state of Oregon for the sale of distilled spirits by the bottle. We have a 5-member board of commissioners that are appointed by the governor, and it's a citizen group of commissioners, and they're charged with administering the Liquor Control Act. We have about 218 FTE, full-time equivalents, throughout the state, and we have more than 235 liquor agents also located throughout the state. The intention of the Liquor Control Act originally was to take the profit motive in the business out of the liquor business and to basically put the sale of distilled spirits into the venue of public safety. Since that time, the Commission has made distilled spirits available to those who desire them, and while at the same time limiting availability and minimizing the problems that are associated with excess consumption. The Commission operates our retail system with three aims to ensure a thriving program. The first aim is that we want to use, and we do use, retail business practices, good business practices. And one of those good business practices are using our liquor agents and their entrepreneurial skills in running their liquor stores. The liquor agents are not state employees, they are contracted agents, and they run their stores as a business. The second is to optimally meet our stakeholders' needs, and we do that to keep the state control system relevant in today's political and economic business climate. And thirdly, we want to continuously look for opportunities in our system to modernize and enhance the way that we do business. We want to look at being more efficient and effective throughout our business goals, and we want to do that through legislative means. So today we have more than 235 liquor agents, and they sell over 900 brands of products to the consumers in this state. Again, these are operated, the liquor stores are operated by contracted liquor agents, They're not state employees. The liquor commissioners appoint these agents through a very competitive selection process. Agents are compensated for their sales based on their sales volumes in their stores. And with that compensation, they make sure that they have all the employees that they need. They pay for their rent. They take care of all of their business expenses. They order their distilled spirits from our warehouse in Milwaukee. We have a 125,000 square foot facility warehouse in Milwaukee where all the distilled spirits are shipped from. And we ship the product to the store, and the state of Oregon actually owns the product until the customer purchases it from the liquor agent. And we have two types of liquor stores. We have exclusive liquor stores. These are typically found in the metropolitan areas. They're generally higher volume stores, and their main purpose is to sell distilled spirits. They may have related items, and probably do. Related items are set out in administrative rule, and basically related items can be anything that it takes to serve or make a drink. So you may find glasses and napkins as related items in some liquor stores, and in some liquor stores you may find milk, eggs, and lemons and limes. And in addition to those types of items, you probably will also find lottery and tobacco products. In smaller rural communities, we have non-exclusive stores, and those stores are run as an adjunct to another business. So you may well find a hardware store that has a liquor store. So that's just a very broad view of what we do with the Liquor Commission. And the first budget note I'd like to talk about is the resignation buyout budget note. Would you like to talk, or you want me to just go on? Okay. The resignation buyout budget note stated that the commission is expected to analyze the benefit of this to the state if the agent buyout provision is increased to 2.5% of the store's average gross alcohol sales for the last 5 years when they terminate their contract, with the 0.5% increase going to state distribution. And again, just a little brief background here. The commission adopted an administrative rule effective January 1997 that allowed an outgoing liquor agent to receive what we call a resignation buyout from the incoming liquor agent taking over that store. The purpose of this buyout was to recognize the agents and all of the hard work that they have put into developing their business. It was basically a recognition of their personal value in the business of the liquor store. The buyout amount equals 2% of the store's average gross annual alcohol sales over the last 5 years, and the financial transaction is actually between the two liquor agents. The only thing the Liquor Commission does is come up with the figure. Since the start of the program through May of 2000, we've had 51 liquor agents retire, and they were eligible to collect a buyout. And the buyout dollars, which have been traded hands in a cumulative nature since the beginning of the program, are $940,000. Now, that figure is a little different than what you have in your report, and the reason for that is we've given you the most recent information, which is through May of 2000. The information in your report is through May of 1999. The average amount to a single agent is about $18,500. However, that figure varies substantially. In the rural areas, a liquor agent may only get about $200 as their resignation buyout. However, in a larger metropolitan area, they may well get $52,000 or more as their resignation buyout. And each year, incoming agents are paying a total of between $235,000 to $253,000 per year in resignation buyouts to get into the system. So the budget note asked for the effect of increasing that buyout by 0.5%. And that 0.5% would be contributed to the OLCC's revenue distribution. The incoming agent would pay the 2.5%. However, the outgoing agent would still receive 2%. And then that 0.5% would flow through our revenue stream. So when that agent comes into the system today, let's say, paying that 2.5%, when they leave the system, they're still only going to get the 2%. In order to recover that other half of percent, they're really going to want to increase their sales. And that's going to be difficult for them to do since the state doesn't allow advertising of distilled spirits and also does not allow anyone to set their prices other than the state of Oregon. And they will also need to offset the effect of inflation on their investment. And the agent would want to further increase their sales because of wanting to recapture those dollars. Over the long term, and I'm talking 20 years here, the liquor sales have not historically kept pace with inflation. That has not been true in the last number of years. They certainly have. As our population has increased, our sales have increased, and we have kept pace with inflation. But if you take a look on the long term, we really have not. And so we predict on the long term, going out another 20 years, we probably are not going to be able, agents probably will not be able to recover their full buyout investment. With the extra half a percent being added to the state's revenue stream, the scenario would gain about $63,000 in revenue for distribution. And on page 2 of the report that you have, you see that the distribution amount actually goes about $35,000 to the general fund, and the balance of that amount goes to city revenue sharing, and counties. We do believe that we would need statutory authority to take in the half a percentage point. All of our fees are set in statute, and this would basically be a fee, so we would need to have that ability. So in conclusion, we believe that raising the percent investment to become a liquor agent without raising that percentage investment when you leave the system may well affect our applicant pool for agencies. We could expect fewer applicants, and we might not get the entrepreneurial applicants that we're currently getting. Folks may decide that the payoff really to them is simply not quite worth it. So, and also another thing to keep in mind is the state would gain a very small amount of dollars from this effort. So thank you very much, and that completes my presentation on revenue.
Thank you. Any discussion on this report? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I served on the General Government Subcommittee, and I think we received a great deal of testimony from agents that our independent agents are struggling. And I think this would be just an added burden to the agents that are already struggling to make a go in a difficult field.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Gregory, has there been a decline in the number of applicants to become agents over the last several years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, no, there have not. As a matter of fact, when we instituted the resignation buyout, we thought that we would have a problem getting qualified liquor candidates. And that has not been the case. As a matter of fact, we have probably ended up getting better candidates with the resignation buyout because the incoming candidates have had to actually put their dollars on the table, so to speak, to get into the business. So we've gotten more entrepreneurial folks since we've instituted this resignation buyout.
Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up.
Representative Witt.
In terms of the commissions or the fees that are being generated by these agents, can you explain to me how they are compensated? Is it through the retail dollars that they sell? What do they pay back to the state? And what has been happening over the last 4, 5, or 6 years in terms of the average income per agent?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, liquor agents are compensated based on their sales. In general, the average compensation for all liquor agents is 8.54%, but that varies from your small liquor agents who may actually receive 18% of their sales to the very large liquor agents who may only receive 6% of their sales. Each liquor agent is paid a certain percentage for every bottle that they sell so that your larger volume stores are going to end up with a lower percentage of sales. Over the last 6 years, compensation has remained at a level that's consistent. It's been 8.54%, and excuse me, that's for the last 4 years. However, sales have gone up. Our forecasts have gone up. Liquor sales have, quite frankly, been very positive. So while the total dollar amount has increased substantially in agents' compensation, the percentage of sale has remained constant.
If I can follow, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Do you believe that the increase in the number of applicants who are interested in becoming agents is reflecting the fact that the overall compensation has been going up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, that's certainly possible. It's also the case that a number of our stores have turned over have been our larger volume stores, and there really is the possibility of making an increase. If you're taking over a store that's been mediocre and you have the entrepreneurial zeal that the resignation buyout has really prompted, then you're able to see that you will be able to make a better profit and therefore more money.
If I can follow, Mr. Chair. Is the state price uniform throughout the state for a particular product, or is it higher in those stores where there's a higher commission paid?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, the state retail is the same throughout the state.
So the state actually receives in some locations a lower dollar amount after commission than it does in other areas of the state. If the commission is higher in some locations, I think that's what I heard you said.
I think that's right, yeah.
Representative Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, I remember being on the General Government Committee in 95, I think, when we adopted this, or when we put this buyout program in. In fact, I guess I have the same question now that I do then. I hear you talk about a positive impact on sales and encouraging the entrepreneurial spirit. What is our objective? Is it to increase liquor sales?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, it's not really to increase liquor sales. What we're really looking for at the Liquor Commission is to bring the retail side of the business into modern merchandising retail environments. We want to make the customer experience in our liquor stores a positive one. Currently, we have a number of liquor stores where people really just don't want to go in. We have heard from people that, women don't want to shop in some of these stores. Some folks don't want to go in. So what we're kind of looking to do with this entrepreneurial bent, if you will, is really bring many of the stores that have not kept up with the retailing of today and to bring them a little more modern, to bring them into the 1990s, the 2000s. So I hope that answers your question.
Follow-up question.
Follow-up.
What I hear is making it a positive consumer experience, increasing sales. It again sounds like the state of Oregon is looking at increasing sales through our liquor stores as being an objective and something we're looking at. And I guess is that counterproductive than all the other money we spend trying to deal with the issues caused by increased alcohol consumption?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, that's, I think, a very good question. One of the things that we are looking to do is, first of all, change this. I guess we're changing the focus a little bit in our liquor stores for our customers to move to the higher end products. We have added credit cards. That has taken that certainly has helped increase sales, but it also has brought the higher priced items to be the items of choice, as opposed to a lot of the lower-priced, higher-consumption products. So the answer is that we are not interested in increasing consumption, and as a matter of fact, consumption has been pretty flat on all of these for a very long period of time, alcoholic beverages in general. We have a slight uptick in distilled spirit sales recently in consumption in this state, but what we are interested in doing, rather than increasing consumption, is bringing up the level of purchase. We want to maintain revenue. We don't necessarily want to get more bottles out there.
Representative Winters.
Thank you. Do we still have state-operated liquor stores?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winters, no. We have no more state-operated liquor stores.
I guess a follow-up. I guess I'm a little concerned. On the one hand, we're talking about a retail marketing an experience, and not to the objective is not to increase consumption. And yet, if I look at marketing and the reason for marketing, it is, in fact, to bring more people in the door. And doesn't OLCC also control the marketing piece of what happens within the store?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winters, as far as what goes on inside the store, that typically is the liquor agent's purview within certain confines. They can have displays in the liquor stores, and that is totally up to them. The Liquor Commission doesn't decide that for them. The only thing that the Liquor Commission deals with within the stores is to make sure that the stores are physically inviting, if you will, and making sure, too, that there's the liquor is being presented properly, that it's dusted and that type of thing.
But there is the image out there that you do want to increase sales if you're going to take with inside of your store to make it look better, to make it more inviting for women, to make it more inviting for the customer to give it a new fix. Isn't then the objective to make sure that we increase sales, whether it's on the high end or the low end?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, that I guess you can come to that conclusion, but that's not what our view is. What we're trying to do really is simply to make these stores a more comfortable place for people to be. We are interested in reaching our sales forecast. We are not interested, though, in going way over or increasing sales substantially.
What is the sales forecast, and how much is the increase over the previous biennium?
The sales forecast for this coming biennium is $451 million. And that's for this biennium, and the increase is about 6% over last biennium.
Thank you for the questions. All right, committee, what we're doing, once again, we're just simply acknowledging the receipt of this report. If you have objections to that, that will be apparent in your comments prior to us taking the vote. In the discussion phase, if you want to reiterate, that's fine, but if you do, please keep it brief. So at this point, at this point in the program, I'd be happy to accept a motion to acknowledge the receipt of the report. Representative Witt.
I move that we acknowledge receipt of this report from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission.
So moved. Is there a discussion? Any objections? Okay. Motion adopted. Okay, thank you. We can move on to our next report, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next report that I'll talk about are the performance standards for the merchandising program. And that budget note stated that the commission shall develop performance standards for the merchandising program that includes store inventory turnover, program profitability, customer service, and the glide path for the $2.9 million inventory reductions. And just a little bit of background on this one. In December of 1999, the Liquor Commission formally adopted several measures, and we've published them in our annual reports. We have annual reports for 1998 and 99. These measures are an outgrowth of our agency's strategic planning process that began in 1996. The Commission executive staff led the development of the performance measures through 97 and 98, and we included our staff in formulating them and putting them together. The measures are used to monitor agency performance. They're not designed to evaluate any individual employee or individual liquor agent at all. We want to see the overall effectiveness and efficiency of the program. As I stated earlier, we have three aims of the merchandising system to ensure a thriving program. And those three aims are managing the retail business using good business principles, particularly our entrepreneurial liquor agents, optimally serving our stakeholder needs so that we can remain relevant in today's business and political environment, And thirdly, to continuously improve and modernize our operations. So the first performance measure in front of you is are our agents' evaluations. And on this, we measure how our liquor agents, how many of our liquor agents receive either satisfactory or better on their annual reviews. Our goal is that 99% of the agents should receive satisfactory or better ratings. And in 1998, we actually had 98% of the liquor agents receive that rating. We've delayed the evaluation for 1999 because we're reevaluating the evaluation form for our liquor agents. So that on agents evaluation, that's pretty much all I have to say on that, and I'll just move on to the return on investment. Okay, the state's return on investment shows how profitable and efficient our merchandising system is. Return on investment is our net profit, and we get to that taking our gross sales, we take out our cost of liquor and our cost of operations, and we divide that by gross sales to get the percentage. Our goal is to maintain a fiscal year return of 39%, and in 98-99, we did maintain that goal of 39%. The next performance measure is our customer service measure. This is what we call our in-stock rate. And the way that we track this is the percentage of distilled orders that are filled at the warehouse whenever our liquor agents order. So basically, the in-stock position in our warehouse is this rate. Our goal is to maintain a 98% in-stock rate so that 98% of their orders are filled fully when they order from us. And in 98-99, our in-stock rate was actually 99%. The next efficiency measure is our warehouse efficiency. And this one we calculate by totaling our case movement. We take all of our cases that come into our distribution center, plus all the cases that get shipped out to all the liquor stores, and we apply that per FTE or full-time equivalent within our warehouse distribution system. And our goal is that each FTE should be moving 93,000 cases a year. And in 98-99, we actually moved 91,000 cases per FTE. And that figure has been going up each year as we increase our efficiency and modernize some things in our warehouse. The next efficiency standard is our store's inventory turnover, and we have not done well on this one at all. We are going to be working very seriously at getting this one in line. This tracks the number of times that inventory in the stores turns over. Basically, if a store has $100,000 in sales a month, they should have no more than $100,000 in inventory, and that will give you a one turn for the year. We have different turnover goals for each of our stores depending on their sales volume. The higher volume stores will have generally higher turnover because the merchandise moves faster, and the rural stores, they have a lower turnover typically. In 1999, only about 20% of our stores actually met their turnover goals. Now, we expect that our new inventory reduction program that I'll be talking about in a minute is going to help us substantially in getting that number better. But we also have a plan for aggressively moving non-selling items out of our liquor stores. And we also have our merchandising business system that we are implementing now, and that will give us the controls that once we have our turns in line, we'll be able to maintain those turns in the stores. So we have a lot of work to do on this performance measure, but we're moving ahead on it, and I'll give you more of the detail in the warehouse and store inventory on the next one, and you'll see exactly how we're going to get this in line.
Thank you. If I may ask, the performance measures, it indicates here on the cover sheet that the measures were adopted apparently without input from the agents themselves or other players involved in the individual performance standards, but it came from internally, came from the staff. Is that true?
That's correct.
Any reason for that?
Mr. Chair, the reason for that is that we saw these performance measures as simply internal efficiencies for us. These weren't being applied to liquor agents. They do have an area on their evaluation for turnover, and to see, you know, how they're doing on their turnover goals. But all of these performance measures really were to rate us as opposed to rate external people.
Questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How can the independent agent, the retail agent, how can the agent affect turnover? If I understand it, and maybe I don't understand your process, but if you're an agent at a store, you order a particular group of products, comes into the store, the state still owns those products until they're sold. How does OLCC, in essence, impact turnover if the agent is ordering the product into the store?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, that's exactly one of our issues. And because the agent doesn't own the product, the agent wants to just order everything that they can, and that's why we have this problem with turnover. Our merchandising business system, once we have it fully implemented, will allow us actually to do centralized ordering for the agents. And while we don't want to get in and totally micromanage the business, what we do want to do is be able to look at the orders that they're processing and be able to question some of them, so that we can get some stores to not have 3 months' worth of inventory.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
So right now there is no limitation, if I understand it correctly, on what the agent can order into the store. So in view of the fact it's like having product on consignments, you can order in whatever you want. That way you always have on hand what anybody who walks in might want. And it doesn't have any negative impact at all upon the retail agent. Is that correct?
Representative Witt, that is correct. The only negative impact is that they are graded down on their performance evaluation at this point.
Does that affect their compensation in any way?
No.
Thank you for the questions.
I guess I'd like a little more explanation on that last comment. If they are receive a poor performance rating in this as a result of overstocking, doesn't it affect them some way? Why even rate them if there's no result?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loken, that's a really good question, and our commissioners also ask that. And that's why we're reevaluating our evaluation form. We are looking at providing an overall score of unsatisfactory, satisfactory, and outstanding. And there would be, you know, if you end up getting a number of unsatisfactories, you may end up with a overall unsatisfactory rating. However, what our new form will hopefully allow us to do is really kind of look directly at issues and deal with individual liquor agents on individual items. And we, too, need the tool to be able to help the liquor agent, and the merchandising business system will allow us to do that. Mm-hmm. Some of our agents have been in the system a long time. Turn was not really real important to liquor agents up until the last few years, nor was it terribly important to the Liquor Commission. And so we really need to educate liquor agents a little bit better, and in order for us to do that, we also need the tool to show them and do it, you know, when they're ordering and say, look, give them a call and say, you know, maybe you need to look at this item. You don't need to order 24 when you only sell 6 a month.
Mm-hmm. Follow up. If there is no input from the liquor agent, and the policy is set, how do you encourage that liquor agent? Is there any incentive for him or her to have their advisory committee, which they do have,
mm-hmm.
Will they be heard? I mean, if OLCC is going to set the rules and have no input, that sounds to me very discouraging to a liquor agent. Mm-hmm. It would seem to me there should be an opportunity for perhaps compromise if it's necessary.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loken, and I presume you're speaking specifically to the turnover goal.
Mm-hmm.
We have not had conversations with liquor agents specifically about their individual goals. However, we also have not held them responsible for them yet. We are talking with liquor agents. We do work with their agents advisory council. We have a meeting next week, as a matter of fact. We really don't institute new things with liquor agents without having quite a bit of dialogue. And when we do new things, you know, we do have the conversation back and forth. Turnover is explained in the retail operations manual, and there's a whole chart that shows, you know, what class stores should have what turnover. So that has been documented, you know, for forever. This was our performance measurement was actually just putting it into a performance measurement criteria that we could actually put into our annual report.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, partially. I think, though, weren't you referring, as you talk about establishing performance standards, to a little broader scale than turnover? Or are we talking only of turnover?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loken, absolutely. The performance measures are a much broader scale, but the only ones that really affect liquor agents are the turnover. I mean, that's one that's kind of directed at them. The next performance measure is actually our warehouse and store turnover combined, which also affects them and affects us too. And absolutely, when we actually get these up and moving and change the turnovers, we will have dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the chart here on the turnover, for example, the first one that of 18 stores, one hit the turnover goal of 1.30. How bad is it in terms? I mean, if the goal is 1.30, for example, how many of these 18 stores are over double that? Do you know those numbers?
I have to ask.
I'll have to pull a file real fast.
I think we'll have to get back to you on that, Representative Lehman.
Representative, another question?
No. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This turnover goal specifically, in setting this, was there any criteria used, for example, of looking at a state that has a more free market, competitive system of selling distilled spirits to determine if these goals are realistic?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, no, there was not. However, as we set these goals, when we get our merchandising business system implemented, these goals that you have on this turnover page, they probably will be changed. 1.30 is a pretty high figure. There are some stores probably that have this goal right now that shouldn't have the goal, and there are some stores that probably could have a higher goal. So.
Yeah, I would just make the point, Mr. Chairman, that setting goals kind of in a vacuum is kind of dangerous in striving to hit them. In reality, as you drive up your turnover, you also increase the likelihood that consumers will not be able to buy products they want to buy when they walk into a store. Now, in a free market, that decision is made by people investing their money into the store and buying inventory. Here, you don't have that case. It's the state's inventory. I would encourage the commission in looking at these kinds of goals to try to use some true free market comparisons so that you have the right balance here between consumer interest as well as the interest in driving up your turnover to hold down the overall invested dollars into the inventory. And setting these things in a vacuum, I think, could be a foolhardy exercise.
Thank you. Further discussion? I thank you. We will accept a motion now to acknowledge the receipt of this report on performance standards on merchandising.
I so move.
So moved by Representative Winters. Discussion? Any objections? Motion carries. Okay, we will move on to our third of four reports.
The next report is on expanding markets, and that budget note states that we should report to the emergency board the feasibility of allowing an expansion in the related item sales by liquor store agents to include specialty beer and boutique wine products and allow package store licensees to sell distilled spirits. The report shall include the impacts on agents and package store licensees. The commission shall identify implementation standards that include but are not limited to addressing the hours of operation, minimizing a negative impact on the state general fund, minimizing the impact on competitively sensitive markets, encouragement of collateral sales of distilled spirits, percentage of shelf facings for non-distilled spirits, and an optimum market penetration. Again, just a little bit of background here. Our control state system of merchandising distilled spirits was adopted in 1933, and originally we did have state-owned stores that sold distilled spirits. However, we actually had agencies at that time, too. Agencies existed from the end of Prohibition till today. Gradually, the larger state-owned stores were converted to liquor agencies, and the reason for that is it was a very cost-effective move for the state and thus a more responsible use of our public funds. We talked about exclusive stores. They're typically in the metropolitan areas, and they sell related items. And the non-exclusives are in the smaller communities. The commission has statutory authority to establish stores for the sales of spirituous liquors and wines and other alcoholic liquors that contain over 5% of volume. And as a matter of fact, the commission actually sold fortified wines in the 1970s. But the sale of distilled spirits was very popular then, and the commission at that point decided that they should be in the business of distilled spirits and gave fortified wine the package stores at that point. Bottled beer and wine are now sold only through our commission as are sold only as package store licensees products. The legislative and commission policy has created the current system, which separates our bottled distilled spirits into a distinct venue from beer and wine. The system serves to minimize the competition between alcoholic beverages, the different styles of alcoholic beverages, and it allows more accessibility to the beverages that have a less alcohol per volume. There are 3,000 package store licensees in the state who can sell beer and wine, while there are 236 liquor stores. Current agency system for selling distilled spirits assures uniform pricing for distilled spirits for customers statewide and protects the state's revenue stream. Now, this budget note asked us to address specialty beer and boutique wines. For the purpose of our analysis, we define specialty beers as anything that was $6 for a six-pack or above. And basically, that would include your expensive microbrews. It would include a lot of your most of your imported beers. What it would not include are your mass market beers. To give you an idea of the market size for specialty beers as we've defined them, the micro beers make up about 2 to 2.5% of the total market, and imported beers make up about 6% of the total market. So specialty beers, as we've defined it here, would certainly be less than 10% of the total beer market today. And then we took boutique wines and defined those as wines that are $14 a bottle or above, for the 750 milliliter bottle. And the market for that in California, for that price and size in the wine business in California, is about 3.8%. So that market is pretty narrow as well. We concluded that very few, if any, of the liquor stores would really be very interested in selling specialty beer or boutique wine. As a matter of fact, really, liquor agencies have suggested that they're not real interested in selling beer and wine. Very few have asked us in the past to add beer and wine. And many agents have actually said, you know, if we sell beer and wine, the package stores are going to want to be selling distilled spirits, and many liquor agents are not too interested in that occurring. A lot of agents, very few agents really have the floor space for adding these bulky items. They have their related items and distilled spirits pretty well contained in their floor spaces, and it would be difficult for them to add some of these items. And the commission believes that people traveling to liquor stores really are traveling to purchase distilled spirits. If you go into a liquor store, it's a destination shop. You're not just kind of popping in to window shop at all. So with the other abilities of buying beer and wine, package stores, having it there just made more sense. if you were to put distilled spirits into package stores, you would probably only find a few brands, the most profitable brands in the package stores, because they're going to want to have their space turning constantly. Allowing package stores to carry distilled spirits will probably not result in a net increase of overall consumption of alcohol. And the reason that I say that is because if a customer goes into a package store that was going to buy alcohol, they may change their choice from beer to wine or distilled spirits. But more than likely, the general alcohol consumption of the three products is going to remain pretty constant. If we do put distilled spirits into package stores, it certainly will provide the store owners of those package stores with a product choice for their customers. But it will also make distilled spirits more accessible to the public and take sales away from the liquor agencies that rely on that product for their livelihood. Now, if the commission were directed to add specialty beer and boutique wines, we would revise our related items rule to allow the specialty beer and boutique wines to the approved list. We have two pages of items currently, and we would simply add these items to that related items list. As far as changing our hours of operation, liquor stores can be open today from 7 a.m. until 10 p.m. In Portland-Salem area, there's only one liquor store actually that's open until 10 o'clock at night, and I don't know of any that open at 7 in the morning. However, in the rural areas, we do have liquor stores that do maintain those hours. In the metropolitan area, folks believe that, after 8 o'clock, there really is a problem with having distilled spirits liquor stores open. So most people do close between 7 and 8, and they probably would not change that. The general fund would suffer a minimal impact, if any at all, if agents had specialty beer or boutique wines. Again, we believe that people go to liquor stores to purchase distilled spirits. We expect little competitive effect on package stores. Agencies would sell very few of these specialty beer and boutique wines, and they would not be generally the type of sales that your convenience stores would be making anyway. Very few convenience stores have these high-end beers and wines as part of their inventory. Concerning the percentage of shelf space for non-distilled spirits in the liquor stores, and we're talking about the agent's related items business, we really try to stay away from that. The related items business is the liquor agent's business, and the only time that we get involved is if, for some reason, the distilled spirits is not being given the floor space that it should be given, or the related items business, for some reason, is being detrimental to the distilled spirits. The commission has the authority to appoint package store owners as liquor agents. We do that. As a matter of fact, in many of the rural communities, most of the rural communities have a number of convenience, small grocery stores and so on, and they are a licensee for the purpose of selling beer and wine and a liquor agent for the purpose of selling distilled spirits. And historically, the commission has appointed individuals only as liquor agents. We have not appointed partnerships or corporations, but the individuals to our contracts. So that ends the portion on specialty beer and boutique wines. The budget note also asked us to look at expanding into new markets. And the commission is looking at adopting a retail business plan. This plan really is a strategic plan for the retail side of the business. It will be a long-term plan for about 5 years, and it encompasses a number of different things. One of them is store expansion. That plan will be coming before our Board of Commissioners in June and for ratification or changing. The business plan calls for expanding stores into new geographic market areas. In 1980, there was one liquor store for every 12,500 people. And as you know, since 1980, we've had a huge growth of population in this state. And in 1998, we hadn't added any liquor stores, so we had one liquor store for every 13,900 people. And had we maintained the ratio from 1980, We actually would have added 26 stores. We're not suggesting we add 26 stores. The draft retail plan calls for adding additional agencies in newly densely populated counties. And those counties are Washington, Benton, Marion, Josephine, Clackamas, Yamhill, and Multnomah. The plan anticipates increasing the number of liquor stores from 234 in 1999 to about 250 by 2305 biennium. And as a matter of fact, in January of 2000, our commissioners appointed three new liquor agents to open three new liquor stores, one in Clackamas, one in Hillsboro, and one in Beaverton. The one in Clackamas opened on April 1st, and the stores in Beaverton and Hillsboro are scheduled to open in July or August. So in conclusion, we believe there's limited interest or benefit to be gained by business people or the state by expanding liquor stores and package stores into broader alcohol beverage markets. However, we do believe it's necessary to expand the liquor stores into the newly densely populated counties to provide adequate customer service and to serve our growing customer base in Oregon. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
In the on the subject of beer and wine and retail liquor stores and also expanding markets, would legislative action be required to make that happen, or is this something that the Liquor Control Commission would attempt to do by rule?
Mr. Chairman, we can do both by rule.
The questions. Representative Winters.
Just an informational question. What is the length of your contracts with the agent?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winters, it varies. we are going through a situation right now where we're revising the contract. Historically, liquor agents coming into the system will get a five-year contract, with the first year being probationary. And historically, as when that contract expires, then they would get a 10-year contract. Our commissioners are looking at changing the term of the contract, and they have not come to a conclusion. But what they have done is for agents who have their contract expiring basically from January on this year, we've granted them a one-year interim contract, and the reason that we did that is that we want to get everybody onto whatever time frame the commissioners choose, and they probably will make that decision in January.
What are some of the criteria that would state that a contract is not renewed? Or what are some of the problems that may occur? Would the inventory turnover be one of those? Since you're looking at that piece now.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winters, I've been with the commission 11 years, and I was director of store operations. We have never not renewed a contract except for one that I know of, and that is because that person took the money that was supposed to go into the state fund. So it has to be a pretty egregious situation for the commission not to renew a contract. Our commissioners are firm believers in performance, and as long as the performance is adequate and satisfactory, there is no question about renewal of contracts. We have very few liquor agents today where that is not the case. The commission is looking at developing specific criteria so that liquor agents will feel a little more comfortable with these performance elements. But there really is not a liquor agent today that I'm aware of that the commissioners would not reappoint.
I wanted to ask about the effect on compensation to existing liquor store owners when a new liquor store is added to a community. And I'm thinking of my own. We don't have many stores there, and it's proposed that there be another. I gather that this determination is made strictly on population, if I follow correctly. Do you take into consideration the effect that adding a new store in a small community or any community will have on the existing agent's income?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. In placing the stores in Clackamas, Hillsboro, and Beaverton, we looked at the impact that might occur to all of the liquor agents in the surrounding areas. We also looked at the impact, and we looked very conservatively at the amount of money the new liquor agent might be making, because that new agent actually is coming into a very high rent retail area. Typically, when you start a business, you start at, you know, a middle of the road rather than going straight to the top as far as volume. What we are discovering is that, at least with the store that we have just opened, it is impacting one liquor agent. It has the ability to impact three. And the one at liquor agent that it is impacting is a store that closes at 6 o'clock at night in the Clackamas area and opens at about 11 or 11:30. So the new store is simply providing better service to the consumer and is therefore taking some of the sales from that particular store. But we look at proximity, the pockets of the population, and we stay hopefully away from existing liquor stores. And we're not really looking at including a liquor store in Grants Pass. We've had that question from some of our liquor agents.
I bet you have. All right. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can a agent own, not own, but I just have the, have more than one location? And do you have that currently?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, currently they do not. The commission is looking at that. We have a number of husband and wife liquor agents. You know, one will have a store in Hillsborough, one will have a store in Forest Grove. Currently, we do not have any liquor agent that has two stores, but the commissioners are looking at that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Is there no requirement on the part of the agents to be open certain hours or a certain number of hours a week?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, liquor agents need to have their liquor stores open between 12 and 6, and they must be open 8 hours a day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further, Representative Loken.
Of course, this goes back to the discussion about contracts, and it's my impression that the language in the I don't know if you have it in operation right now, if it's effective, but has been changed from shall renew contracts to may renew contracts. Doesn't that put a considerable amount of concern and indecision perhaps about whether an agent should continue if it's left so vaguely?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loken, the term for renewal in the agency contract, the first sentence of that talks about the commissioner's renewal shall be at the sole discretion of the commissioners.
Mm-hmm.
And then the old contract said the commissioners will reappoint, and they changed that will to may so that indeed they would have that discretion. But what is said after that is that it's all based on performance. It's based on the performance evaluation. It's based on, you know, liquor agents knowing a certain amount of time up front that they may not be renewed. So I think it's pretty clear in that paragraph that even though the commissioners in the interim contract changed the will to may, this, the renewal still is based on those performance standards.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Further.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Do you have authority now over sale of beer and wine in other than the stores that you fully license?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, yes, we do. We license all of the stores that sell beer and wine in the state, and if there are compliance issues, we work with those folks to get them into compliance.
Another question, Mr. Chair. The reason I ask is I seem to remember someone telling me that Oregon was different than some other states in that distributors couldn't place products in, say, grocery stores and sell them kind of on consignment, that the retailer actually had to purchase the product before they could put it out on the shelves.
And that's true.
And is that your rule that requires that?
Those are actually our Tide House statutes that require that. And we have a three-tiered system in the state, and wholesalers cannot be involved with any kind of financial benefit to retailers regarding the sale of beer or wine. That's, we have our wholesalers that have to be paid to meet immediately that we don't, retailers can't purchase on credit from wholesalers. And that's where your question comes from. But I do not pretend to be an expert on our Tide House statutes. They are very complicated, and I'm not real familiar with them. Thank you.
Any further?
Just a comment. They also license restaurants.
Thank you, Representative Winters. All right, we'll go ahead and accept the motion here to acknowledge receipt of this report. And for the record, this report deals with store expansion into new markets, feasibility of expanding related liquor sale items. Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Representative Hansen moves. Do we have any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, report adopted. All right, we'll move to our fourth and final report.
Thank you. The final report is from our regulatory program, and this has to do with the cost to issue a liquor license. We were asked to look at the administrative cost to establish a license and or transfer an existing license compared to the fees charged. And again, just a brief background, our OLCC regulatory program grants liquor licenses, and it charges fees set by statute. These licenses give individuals and businesses the privilege to wholesale and retail alcoholic beverages, including beer, wine, and distilled spirits by the drink. Licenses are issued according to specific criteria set by statute and administrative rule. The regulatory program actually makes up the bulk of the commission. We've talked a lot about our merchandising program this morning, but most of our resources really are devoted to our regulatory program. In addition to conducting license investigations and granting liquor licenses and renewals, we also renew liquor licenses every year, and we have 8,000 of them. The program investigates liquor law violations, and we work with licensees to achieve compliance. And we also have a server ed component. We oversee the server education providers who provide education to everyone who sells distilled spirits, beer, or wine by the drink. And we have 17,000 of those permittee holders who come through each year. Out of our 218 employees, we have about 96 in the regulatory program. And about half of our support services at the Liquor Commission are devoted to facilitating regulatory doing its work. And by support services, I'm talking about our information services, our fiscal services department, human resources, and so on. The regulatory program is funded as part of the overall OLCC administrative limitation, which is established biannually by the legislature. The regulatory program has never been self-funded. Part of the regulatory program collects license fees, which are part of the OLCC income stream. And the program also assesses fines for violations, and we also have the service permit application money that comes through. And all of the fees and sanctions are all established in our state statutes. So in our budget note, you asked us to look at issuing major license types. And what we did was we used 1997-99 data because that's the most recent that we had for a full biennium. We took all the direct costs of the regulatory program. That's all the people and services and supplies that actually work in the program. And we added to that the indirect costs, the information systems department, half of that, and so on. And we came up with a total of $16.1 million for the biennium that it is biennium, right? For the biennium, thank you, as the cost of the retail program. Total income from the regulatory-related activities, all of the fees that come through and the fines and so on, comes to about $4.8 million in the biennium. So we actually receive about 30% of our expenses. Now, the time and processes differ quite substantially depending on the kind of license that we issue. So we focus just on six of our licenses. And these licenses are basically all of our retail licenses, and they pretty much cover all 8,000 of our licensees who are in the retail business in one form or another. The six license types are dispenser Class A, which basically is our sale of beer and wine or distilled spirits by the drink, and these types of premises have a separate lounge. The dispenser Class C also sells beer, wine, and distilled spirits by the drink, but they have no separate bar. This might be a restaurant where the drinks just come from the back area or the kitchen. In the restaurant, you can have the sale of beer or wine under 21% alcohol by the drink. And then we have a retail malt beverage license where you have the sale of beer, which is under 10% alcohol, and wine under 14% alcohol by the drink. And this one also allows sales to go. This is where you get your keg sales. Now, the difference between a restaurant and a retail malt beverage, restaurant will typically have food as their main element of their business, whereas in the retail malt beverage license, often there is very little food available at some of these establishments. The package store is your 7-Eleven or Fred Meyer or whatever, and that's the sale of beer and wine to go. And then we have the brew pub, McMinniman's, for instance, and they have the sale of beer and wine by the drink, as well as the beer brewed on the premises that you can take with you. So we took our staff costs, and this is based on the average hours that our investigators worked on these licenses, and we also included any of our technician costs, reviewing managers, or anyone involved with this. And we did it for all the new licenses, and we also did it for change of ownerships. And the staff are the ones who reported their time. We had them do a little computation here. And then we computed the indirect law costs and added that to it. And we compared that to the license fee as of January 1st, 2001. And what Alex is showing you here is a comparison that's actually not in your report. It shows you what it costs to issue a license for a new outlet in each of those six categories, how much it costs for the change of ownership, and what the license fee will be in January of 2001 when our license fees actually change. Historically, our fees have remained stable and low. Some of the rationale behind the legislature's policy may be that the legislature views the commission's licensing function more as a means of enabling people to enter the business rather than as an obstacle. In 1999, the legislature adopted the commission's bill to restructure the licenses, and we reduced 30 annual license types down to 12, and this included consolidating 13 different retail licenses into three very broad categories. So those six licenses actually will go away, and they will be in a broad category come January 1st. And the fees increase just for some licenses and only slightly for those. Most of the information I'm discussing now is on Attachment 3 of your report. In general, most states charge substantially higher fees than does Oregon. And some also charge a different fee for initial licenses because they really do involve a lot more investigative work. Changes of ownership really don't get all that involved. So in conclusion, in our state, the fees that we charge for liquor licenses offset only a portion of the administrative costs of processing the application and issuing the license. And I want to thank you all for the opportunity to report on all of these budget notes and would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? All right, thank you. We'll go ahead and accept a motion here. And this motion will be to accept the report, acknowledge the report relating to costs to issue licenses.
I so move.
Representative Winters moves. Further discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, report is accepted. And we'll close the work session relating to emergency reviews. All right. Thank you very much. We are going to get a 20-minute start here on lunch, but we will reconvene at the published time here, which will be 1:15. Our subject this afternoon, public employees retirement system. I expect that to move right along. Appreciate your participation in that. Thank you very much, and we'll go ahead and adjourn.